The Home Show with Sinead Ryan.
With Mila.
Saturday morning at 8. On News Talk.
Hello, and you're very welcome along to the latest episode of the Home Show podcast. My name is Sinead Ryan, and coming up this week, never mind a bit of fish for dinner, what about a whole tank in your living room? Are we entering the age of aquariums? Stained glass windows are so beautiful and they have been for many, many centuries. But what's involved in restoring and conserving them? We'll be finding out how to design the perfect nursery for your newborn and all things Italian with Natasha Rocca Devine. If you'd like to get involved in the show, we always love to hear from podcast listeners at thehomeshow@newstalk.com on email. You can find me over on socials at SineadRyan100. And of course, all of the items are up on podcasts. You can listen back to any of those at your leisure. Now, when we go on holidays, there's always that balancing act between doing cultural things and then the more prosaic activities such as finding the local pub. But you can find a real gem in lots and lots of places, especially city breaks. And for me, it's often a church or a castle. And one of the things I love seeing is a beautiful stained glass window. Cologne Cathedral strikes me as a magnificent example in an otherwise kind of drab city. And the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona, of course, haven't been finished yet. That has other examples. And of course, we've lots and lots of beautiful stained glass around our own Irish churches as well. So I'm really excited later on to be talking to an expert on stained glass and a restoration project that she has been involved in. But let me know what your favourite stained glass is. Is it your local church? Is it a big cathedral? Is it somewhere you've seen abroad? I'd love to hear from you. 53106 for 30 cent or thehomeshow@newstalk.com. And you're very welcome along to the show.
This is the dawning of the age.
Hippies and astrologers may disagree on whether we are actually in the age of Aquarius, but if our next guest business success is anything to go by, well, we are most certainly in the age of aquariums. Keelan Doyle is the founder of Seahorse Aquariums, and he and several other guests have joined me here in studio. Keelan, you're very welcome along to the Home Show.
Brilliant. Thanks for having me.
I am fascinated by aquariums. I absolutely love them. And I love what you've brought into us here. So tell us a little bit about keeping aquariums at home. How popular is it? People have done it for a very long time. And what do you think it is that people like about it?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of people have done it for a long time. Believe it or not, it's actually the oldest hobby in the world. Yeah, it goes back to the time of the Ming Dynasty, the Romans, the Pharaohs, the Greek mythologists, they all kept aquariums. And it's been continued from that day to this. And at the moment, it's actually the fastest growing hobby in the world. So
really?
It's fascinating.
And do you think it is because people keep them as the ultimate pet? It's a sign of maybe luxury or certainly in those olden times, a kind of a sense of the decadence of being able to do it? Or was there some other reason, do you think?
I think going back in time, there's always been a fascination, I suppose, with humans for domesticating animals. And because fish were something that were so little known about, because essentially they're in water and we don't see them, the idea of being able to have them visible, and they're relatively easy to keep. So I think going back, there's always been this this fascination, and it's obviously spread through every cohort, through every part of the world. And in recent times, I think what's changed is, you know, it's the whole mental health. It's the whole idea of trying to bring nature into your home. Mm. You know, we've become disconnected. We've become concrete cities. And the idea of being able to bring a bit of the outside inside, I think, is what's really appealing to people.
And of course, we've seen that time and time again with guests in this studio after COVID, everything from plants or biophilic interiors to home offices to pets, you know, the lockdown dogs and all that. So do you think there is part of that involved in it? People find having fish restful or mindful in some way. And as you say, it's not terribly hard to do at a basic level.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we felt over the years that's now been proven scientifically. And it's really fascinating. Recent studies in the UK have shown that watching fish has the same effect on the brain as meditation. And this is really, really interesting. If you spend 5 minutes watching a fish tank a day, it has an 8% reduction in blood pressure and a 15% reduction in heart rate. So essentially, it's active mindfulness. And, you know, I think you'll agree, I don't think there's anybody on the planet who couldn't deal with a bit of that right now.
I think the first aquarium I ever saw, and I'm thinking of it now, I was about 7 or 8, and it was in the dentist's clinic where my mother used to bring me. And I wonder now, did he have an aquarium just to calm everybody down? So by the time we went in to be examined, we were in a state of, you know, nearly zombie-like meditation. Maybe you're right. I don't know.
But you see, that's the one I can think of. Back then, I mean, a similar story, somebody told me that the old nurse way back when in the old Temple Street Hospital, she used to have a fish tank. And whenever she was putting the needle in to take bloods with the kids, she'd get them to look at the fish. And when they were mesmerized by the fish, you get a jab in the arm. And you know, and again, it's that. And it's changed as well, Sinead. I suppose back in the day when I was a kid, fish tanks were dirty. They were smelly. They were noisy. Now they're pieces of furniture. You know, back then it was all about the plastic ornaments, the no fishing signs. That's all gone. Now it's recreating. Like the buzzword is aquascaping. And aquascaping is recreating landscapes underwater. So essentially, if you were up the Wicklow Mountains walking and you see a beautiful scene, the idea is that you recreate that underwater.
Oh, go away. A bit like the train, the people who collect model trains, they want to recreate the
exactly.
view around them. How interesting. Now, before we go any further, let's introduce our other guests here. So tell me what you've brought in, Keelan.
So we've brought in some of the babies that we produce. So one of the reasons why fish keeping is a lot easier is that, you know, pretty much every fish you buy now has been captive bred, which is fantastic. So we have a couple of examples of the guys we breed. First of all, we have our Nemos, which of course are clownfish.
Yeah. They're tiny.
Tiny. These are only about 3.5 weeks old.
Ah.
Beautiful characters.
They're all huddled together in a bunch there. Is that what they like to do? They're kind of taking their cue from each other.
That's what they do. So it's sort of strength in numbers at this point. And the really, really unusual thing about clownfish is that they're all born boys. So everyone you're looking at here is a boy. And of course, I think they were ahead of their time because this group will start to sort of separate into couples. And what happens then is that one of the boys will have a sex change and become a girl. And she then, I suppose she, to me, she gets the handy number because he cleans the area that they're going to lay the eggs. He collects the food. He fans the eggs. And her job is literally just to eat and lay the eggs.
I'm liking them better and better the more I see of them. That's fantastic. How very woke of them. So they're absolutely gorgeous. And of course, people who know Finding Nemo will know that the orange and white and black striped fish. How big will they grow, Keelan?
They get about an inch and a half. The woman, because she doesn't do as much as the man, she tends to get a little bit bigger.
Ah, of course.
The fella stays small because he's quite active. And, you know, the thing about a clownfish is that in the wild, they live in a little flower called an anemone. It's a kind of a little relationship or symbiotic relationship. So the beauty of them is if you keep them in an aquarium, whether you put them in a tank that's a foot wide or 10 metres wide, they still stay in the same area. So they're that's their natural behaviour. So they're very happy in a smaller aquarium.
Mm. Okay, well, that's the clownfish. Now, you've also brought in, and even I know the name of this one, these are seahorses.
Well, if you think it's good being a female clownfish, it even gets better as a female seahorse, because I'm sure as many of your listeners will know out there, the seahorse is the only animal in the whole wide world that, of course, the male and not the female has the babies. And it gets better. He does a dance around the female every morning of their lives, right? So he's a morning person. And even better than that, he stays completely faithful. And if she passes away, he will die of a broken heart. So this is a real love story.
Well, now, isn't that the perfect way to live?
like an Irish man, so they say, you
yeah,
know?
And of course, he has all the babies, which is utterly fantastic, in my view. And how many babies does he have in one go?
So, of course, us men, if we do it, we do it right. And the male seahorse can give birth to up to 4,000 babies. And the day he gives birth, she actually is ready and waiting, and she impregnates him the same day.
Once again, she hasn't had enough with that, and she's to go off and feed them then for the rest of their good days. Right, all right, send them out to work is what I say. Fantastic. So that's the seahorse. Now, talk to me about then what you said earlier, that the aquarium or the fish tank has become part of the furniture, because lots of people like to have them in the house or like to think of them in the house. And I suppose for most children, it can be a fun way to start a hobby. But you're actually against the way most people do it, which is putting a goldfish in a fishbowl.
Yeah, so there's a campaign which we would be actively pushing, which is called Ban the Bowl. And unfortunately, the vast, vast majority of goldfish that are bought don't do well. And that's been kind. And it's because you literally put them in a bowl without any filter. You know, a fish needs good quality water. As I say to people, you're a water keeper, not a fish keeper. You know, fish keeping is actually unbelievably easy once it's done right. Mm. And you don't have to spend much money to do it right. So that's the key. It's have a small filter, have the right size tank. And then the benefits are endless. I mean, you know, for us, of course, it's a business. But the common feedback we get from parents, you know, is that the kids aren't spending nearly as much time on the phones. The TV is not being watched nearly as much, because the tank is their hobby, is their fascination.
Absorbing.
And it's learning. Mm. It's learning. It's nature.
So where would you recommend somebody get started then? What size tank? What do you need for it? How much will it cost?
You know, the new sort of trend, traditionally people went for sort of bigger aquariums in a sitting room. Now everything from sort of small desktop aquariums, which can be on your desk, bedroom aquariums. I mean, you're talking from €100 up. You know, literally every budget, every type of fish. And the small aquariums, you know, years ago, goldfish is what you kept. Now there's like little catfish, there's little frogs, there's little snails, there's beautiful coloured shrimp. There's amazing species, very, very small and very, very easy keep. And then, of course, you can go all the way up to, you know, customised aquariums, which is what we make. So there's a huge range from the small up to the very large.
And when it comes to the very large, then, what are people looking for?
Probably people are really enjoying aquariums built into a wall. That's a very common thing at the moment. They're looking for room dividers.
The room divider is the aquarium.
The room divider is an aquarium.
Okay.
We're doing a lot actually in smaller apartments at the moment, where you have a kitchen come sitting room. And of course, the couple come home in the evening and, you know, one is watching telly and one is cooking, and, you know, somebody wants just their little bit of space, but they're not getting it. And it's amazing by putting an aquarium that you can see through, but it just gives that little separation of a room and everybody can just chill and enjoy. So, you know, that's the type of thing. If it's customized, it looks like it was always there.
Right. And I suppose then you can give tips and hints about how to care for them and change the filters and the water and what to feed them and all that kind of thing. Do different species like different things to eat, or is it just the amount of food?
Again, because they've been calved to bred, within reason, they all eat the same food. You know, I suppose, because the filters have got better, because the tanks have got better, because the fish are captive bred, because they're quiet, because they're sort of designed, it really is easy. And it makes me sad when people sort of tell me, oh, they got fish and they didn't survive. And it's always sort of bad advice. Very, very, very basic steps at the start. And it is amazing. What we find is people come into us and they might start with a small tank and it follows up. Then they get into it because they get the confidence. And we're there nearly 20 years. And there's now second and third generations coming back. Mm. So it's lovely to see a family. You know, we have three generations of families coming into us where all three of them have tanks. And
yeah.
it gives us a great buzz back.
Yeah. One of those hobbies that becomes maybe an obsession or something that you get absorbed in. Now, I see somewhere, and I found this hard to believe because I've never heard of it before, that you're in the process of growing fish sustainably to eat at home?
So what we're doing is we're growing fish. So we have two different things. So we are growing fish sustainably in, we have a farm down in Offaly, okay? And we are using, we're using the heat from the bog to generate warm water so we can grow the fish completely carbon neutral. It means we don't have to import them from abroad. And this technique has been used for aquarium fish and also for food fish. So it's really interesting, totally organic, and it's a completely carbon neutral way of producing our food. So it's very exciting.
Can you ever see a time when people will do that? They'll have fish at home themselves that they've, at home to eat?
Well, even, I mean, the whole thing we're doing a lot with now is aquaponics. I mean, for example, we've done a big project for Belvedere School and they won a massive international award. It is the way of the future where essentially you use plants to clean the water and the fish feed the plants. So essentially your water from your fish tank pumps your plants. Mm. So your herbs, your strawberries, your lettuce, etc. like that. And that water then gets cleaned by your plants because essentially it's food in it. And that comes back to your tank and it feeds your fish. So it's a completely clean, sustainable method.
Circular
method, yeah. of producing fish and plants. I mean, we have a guy in work and he has a polytunnel out the back and you literally go out and he picks up his lettuce that's fed by his fish. He catches a fish and within minutes you have the most beautiful, organic, healthy meal. And trust me, that is the way of the future.
All right. Well, listen, thanks a million, Keelan, for bringing in these lovely, very well-behaved guests, I have to say. They're probably among the most well-behaved we've had in studio over the years. And it's absolutely lovely. I'm going to let them get back to their natural home now. I'm sure these lights and surroundings aren't quite what they had expected. Where can people find out more about what it is you do?
So we are based at the Red Cow and we also have a shop in Galway. At the Red Cow, we have a showroom. So it's for people to come out and look at different options of tanks, but from small to big. And the website, the shop's name is Seahorse Aquariums and the website is seahorseaquariums.com.
Fantastic. And there's loads and loads of different options there and more exotic fish the more you look into it. Keelan Doyle, founder of Seahorse Aquariums, thank you very much and your guests for joining us in studio today.
Thank you for having me.
The earliest examples of stained glass windows date back to the 7th century AD, but it still continues to be used to this day. And its ubiquity in buildings of a certain age and certain type means that practitioners of a very specific skill set are required, whether creating or conserving this beautiful art form. One such project is taking place at Johnstown Castle in County Wexford, and its restorer joins me now, Colette Langan, founder of Langan Stained Glass. You're very welcome along to the Home Show today.
Thank you very much, Sinead.
Now, before we get on to the Johnstown Castle project, which I know was very, very hard work, tell me a little bit about how you got started in the business of stained glass.
Oh, I started by going to a night class. I lived in Carrick-on-Shannon and went to London afterwards after I did my leaving cert. And I went to a night class and it was stained glass. I thought, oh, that's interesting. I wonder how that's done. And from there, I got a very lucky break when I went to the glass shop. There was a little sign saying somebody's required for a studio. And it turned out that it was a very sought after studio. And I got to work with the most amazing glass. And I got a great experience there. My first day at work, I started on Lincoln Cathedral.
Wow, that's a good start. Now, it is, of course, an incredibly specialised area, considering we're dealing with art, which can date back centuries. So tell me a little bit about the difference between conservation work and restoration work.
Well, with conservation, as much of the glass is saved. So that would mean that there would be glue, a lot of glues involved, and then the glue would have to be protected. So backing plate would be needed. There can be systems that are called isothermal glazing, where the window is brought into the interior of the building and there's a new set of glass made to go externally, which will take the weather. But say for restoration, that is when glass is made to look like it was old, but it would be new and it would be maybe complete the image in a in a way that conservation may not complete it in quite the same way.
Mm. So you may have to make new bits, as it were, and re-put them back into whatever piece is missing. And in terms of the work that you do, I presume you have to be extremely careful when you're working with such old frames or indeed the glass itself. So how painstaking is the work?
It depends a lot on the condition of the work. Sometimes stained glass windows, they can look in fairly good condition until they're taken out of the rebate, and then they just want to collapse because it's the rebate itself that's holding it all together and the bars that they're tied to. So that can be an issue, just getting the glass down without further damage to it, because it could easily fall apart at that stage.
Mm. I can imagine. Yeah. And that's the last thing you want. You're opening up this beautiful window which hasn't been touched in 400 years and the whole lot smashes on the ground. It's not very helpful. Now, talk to me a little bit about this project that you did recently at Johnstown Castle. What was required and what did you have to do?
Yeah, that was a really exciting project. I didn't have to do any of the taking out the window at all. So that arrived to my studio in a crate and some folders with smashed glass. Just laying that all out and just looking at it took quite a long time, and just trying to assemble the glass. If window has been vandalised, that the fragments are picked up, because they are really, really useful and they're a very good guide to me on what was there originally.
And is that what had happened? The window had been vandalised and broken and you had to kind of push it together like a jigsaw?
Yeah, exactly that. I think it had been shot at. And which very often in this instance is that the most sensitive areas, such as the faces and the hands, they were damaged. And the inscription was also, there was a section of the inscription totally missing. So it was quite a challenge to try and figure out what was there.
Mm, so because it had to commemorate something or mention whoever had commissioned it or whatever. So so that involves then you being a bit of a detective, I suppose.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's weeks of work in research. I collaborated with Matt Wheeler a lot on what information he had been able to get. And people had given some information about badges and so on that would have been military badges. But I did my own detective work on the inscription and the missing words. And I was very lucky to discover that the words actually belonged to a scroll that was presented to families that had lost their loved ones in the First World War. Mm. So there was this inscription that came with a medal, and that was the exact same inscription that was used in the stained glass window.
Ah, so you were able to find it and then incorporate it accurately into what you were making up.
Yeah, and I had enough fragments to be able to establish the names and how they were positioned and what way they were written.
Well, it certainly is a beautiful art form. And I must say, as I said at the top of the show, I've seen some very, very fine examples of it in churches mainly, but of course, lots of other places like castles, like Johnstown Castle. And if people want to go down and have a look at it, is the work finished now, Colette, down there?
Yes, it is. It's we had the unveiling of the window last week and it's open for people to go and see. It's well worth going down there and having a look at the entire place.
Indeed. All right. Well, Colette Langan, founder of Langan Stained Glass, who was in charge of that restoration project, thank you so much for joining us with that on The Home Show. Now, the nursery is probably the only room in your house that you design in the knowledge that you will inevitably change its function in a relatively short period of time. So how should this influence our decisions when planning a space for your baby? Well, Joanne O'Grady is co-founder of Gaia Baby and joins me now in studio. Joanne, you're very welcome to The Home Show.
Thank you, Sinead. It's lovely to be here.
Now, do you think parents today, and it was a long time ago since I had my babies, put too much store in something like a nursery. I mean, that wasn't even a name we had for a room.
No, it wasn't a thing at all. It wasn't a thing at all.
It was like the spare room or, you know, the box room.
Yeah. No, I think it has changed dramatically now. Obviously, it's a long time since I had children, but I've been involved in the industry a lot for the past 20 years. But in the past, I'd say, 7 to 8 years, there's been a huge increase in the emphasis on designing your nursery. Mm. It's a big, big thing on social media, and the nursery reveal is kind of the next thing after, you know, the sex of the baby or whatever. So, yeah, it's totally changed from our day. Thankfully, I think, because, you know, I think there were a lot of pitfalls and maybe mistakes that people made in relation to furnishing a nursery or providing a space for a baby.
Yes, indeed. And of course, there is that old adage that, you know, there was a time in this nation's history when baby was stuck in the bottom drawer, and that was its purpose because there was nowhere else to put, and there was no suggestion of decorating it. And thankfully, that has all changed now. So when you're designing a nursery, I mean, I presume you're not actually designing it for your baby to look around and go, wow, I'm so glad I've been born into this family. You're really designing it for yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think that's a really important consideration, because I think, from what I can see, a mistake that a lot of people make or have made is they design it thinking it needs to be nice for the baby. Mm. But the reality is that you're going to spend a huge amount of time in that room.
Okay.
And so it has to be a space that you're comfortable in and that you enjoy being in. So if you think back to your days of trying to put the baby to sleep, that really does occupy a lot of
feeding,
your time. Feeding.
Changing.
Putting them
dressing
down, taking them up, changing them and whatever. And that all happens in the nursery. So it is important that it's an environment that suits you and maybe suits the decor of the rest of your house, which a lot of people kind of forget as well. So so that's a consideration.
And what are the mistakes then people make if they are designing it poorly? Because I presume it's that the prettiness and the beauty overtakes the function of it. Would that be a mistake, or can you have both?
I think you can certainly have both. But one thing that I always say to first-time parents is that when they are designing the nursery, it's probably the only opportunity that they will get to have it designed how they like it. So once your child gets to 3 or 4 years old, you know yourself, it's all going to be Dora the Explorer or dinosaurs or whatever it may be. And you actually don't get a look in then again until they leave home. Mm. So that room will not be yours to decorate. So that's why I say it really is important, I think, to make sure that it does actually suit your taste and also makes you feel rested and calm.
Mm. But that said, if you're planning on using a nursery and it transitioning into your children's bedroom, I presume that you can put a design ethos in place that allows that carryover. Yep. So it's kind of less of the fluffy pink ruffles maybe and more of animals or nature colours or whatever.
Yeah. So if we're thinking specifically decor, I definitely would say most people nowadays, and I would recommend go neutral and use pops of colour or, you know, soft accessories to actually personalise it or make it babyish. And then the other really major consideration is making sure that the pieces of furniture you choose can actually evolve with the child. So when my kids were young, we moved around a lot from country to country, and I made the mistake of buying cheap practical but cheap furniture that once you took it apart, you could not put it back together again. So it did not make the transition from house to house. That's certainly a consideration. And the other thing is also space. So, for example, a lot of, say, a specific nursery sets, let's say, with storage pieces of wardrobes or dressers, they won't actually fit a child's clothes in once they get to age 7 or 8. So check and see if an adult size hanger can fit in the wardrobe.
And that the depth is there, because those tiny little cutesy kind of baby grows turn into maybe trousers or dresses.
Exactly, exactly. And actually my experience was by age 7 or 8, I couldn't hang my children's clothes for school, like school uniforms didn't fit in the wardrobe I had bought.
Disaster. And also, it seems to me that children's furniture, when it's bought well and it's sustainable, is one of those pieces that I've seen the most incredible transformations between a little sit-in chair and then a high chair. And I had one at one stage. It was a little rock boat.
Oh, yeah.
And then you stood it up and it became a high chair at the kitchen table. And
oh, yeah.
It lasted, I don't know how many children, not only mine, because it had that dual function.
Yeah. So a lot of furniture now, and to look out for, what people can look out for is pieces that actually evolve and go through different stages. Sometimes the evolution, in my mind, like I'm very practical, and a lot of times the evolution mightn't actually be relevant, like maybe a crib that turns into a desk. So in between it being a crib and a desk, what do you do with it?
Maybe a crib that turns into a bed that you can take off the little side pieces, something like that would be better, would it?
Now, funny you should mention that, because actually Gaia Baby have a unique design of a co-sleeping crib. So co-sleeping, very important now for parents. And generally speaking, the co-sleeper is going to be in the parents' room. But we've actually got a collection called the Serena Collection, where the co-sleeping crib, and it's actually the only one in the world, converts into a full-size cot. So now, you use the same piece.
Is co-sleeping, I mean, is that not something that we're trying to not have? Is it not a little bit dangerous to have baby and mom kind of together? Because there can be instances. Are you talking about like a separate unit to the side of the parents' bed?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay.
So I think generally they would be called co-sleeping cribs or a co-sleeper, some people refer to them as.
Right. So handy for breastfeeding in the middle of the night, but they're separate. Good. You're not going to roll over and crush them.
No, I mean, there's a huge amount of safety standards associated with them. And certainly if people are looking at one, make sure that it is certified to the highest safety standard. There's a new EN standard, and it's really important that they comply with that.
Okay, so tell us then, in terms of the fun stuff now, what kind of thing is on trend at the moment? What are people going for in nurseries?
On trend at the moment, well, I would say the big reveal is really a significant factor. But a lot of people now, and that is a change from our day, are actually looking for pieces that are equally at home, let's say in the nursery and in your living space. So if you don't have the luxury of having a big nursery, you can put your, for example, your feeding or rocking chair in the living room.
Yeah.
But it has to look nice.
And it doesn't have to be identifiable just for that.
Exactly.
It can just be a lovely easy chair. Okay. Because
they
are not cheap. Some of them come at a fierce reckoning. And, you know, if you're breastfeeding, you absolutely want to be comfortable. You want to be able to sit back a bit, keep your feet up possibly, and be able to then translate that, because, you know, you've spent a lot of money on it.
Yeah.
So does that work then in terms of furniture too? Because are you saying that the nursery furniture, it's best if it doesn't look very babyish or designed specifically for a nursery? Is it better that you could use, say, neutral woods or something you can use for something else then?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would definitely recommend people go for pieces that can transition. So if you look at a piece of furniture and it's specifically designed for a nursery and you wouldn't have it anywhere else in the house, I think steer away. I would definitely recommend look for something that's classic and, as I said earlier, suits your style.
Yeah.
And that you'd be happy to have it in the hallway later on, or, you know, a storage piece in a different room.
Yeah, because a changing table is just a chest of drawers, really,
exactly.
Isn't it? And you can have everything to hand.
Yeah.
But the chest of drawers itself doesn't have to be pink or blue or, flowers all over it or whatever. All right. That's fantastic. So if somebody is in that zone now and they are preparing their nursery, what tips would you give them to get started? I know one of the big bugbears is about paint, because people don't like the toxic paints or smelly paints. I know paint suppliers are getting brilliant at this nowadays, and there's kind of very, very good and vegan paints as well, and stuff that has no smell on it. Is that a good idea? Is that popular?
Yeah. So again, you could look out for, when you're shopping for furniture, look out for furniture that has child-friendly paint. Sometimes it's called VOC-free. And the kind of more quality pieces would have water-based paint. On the walls, I think it's important as well to make sure you get a quality paint. Obviously, wipeable is a consideration, but a lot of paints now actually have a like an emissions rating on them. So you can look for one that is specifically child friendly.
Fantastic. I was a great eater of paint when I was a baby.
Really?
And I'm sure there was nothing friendly about it at all. No. I used to pick the little flakes off and eat them off the wall. Yeah. Don't know what my body was craving, but there you go. A bit of colour on the inside, perhaps. Joanna Grady, co-founder of Gaia Baby. Where can people find you on socials, Joanna?
Yes, GaiaBaby.com. And we're an Irish founded company. We design and develop the furniture, and it's all made from sustainable FSC certified wood.
Fantastic. We love that on the home show. All right, Joanna, very best of luck.
Thanks, Mindy.
And all the new mums and indeed dads can make the way there and chat to you about that.
Great.
Thanks for joining us in studio.
Okay.
And you're very welcome back to the home show podcast with me, Sinead Ryan. And we are going to go on a little trip to Italy. It's everybody's favourite holiday destination. It is springtime, and who better to have with us on our journey, which might only be to your back garden, but our Italian, Natasha Rocco Devine.
How are you?
And actually, you are half Italian, are you not?
Yeah, my family are Rocco. I'm from Parma. My great granddad and granddad. Like, but I feel like if you're at a family event, Sinead, it's like a it's like an Italian. All the dark haired women and all the fiery energy and the food everywhere. It's very Italian. My family, the Rocco family. So yeah, so I, you know, it's just innate in me in my design. And when I look back at videos, my hands movements and the way I dress and all the rest. So yeah, I love Italian design. And I was recently in Italy with Cucina Libby Kitchens. And got to spend time in Rome, and I'd never been. So,
we
discussed that before. It was magical.
Magic.
So, I think just bringing those trends in for the Irish would be, or anyone online would be amazing.
Yeah. Now, we don't always get to live the Dolce Vita here with the weather we have, but families in Italy love food.
Absolutely.
And don't they love getting together for food, like in a multi-generational way? There's no thing of, it seems to me, of let's feed the kids and put them to bed and then have our proper dinner.
Oh, no, not at all. Everyone, like when you go to restaurants, there's babies there, there's grannies there, there's everyone in between, there's friends and family. My family are a little bit like that. You know, I'm just building my own house, and I actually, like my partner said to me, like, it's literally like, how many people are you trying to fit in the space? Like the bedrooms don't care about, as in it's all about the open spaces and the kitchen and the dining. I'm like, my familia have to visit, all my cousins.
Yeah.
And stuff. So it is very, I think, I'm not saying I'm fully Italian or anything, but I do think it's a cultural thing. And particularly, I think kitchens are, you know, the centre of the home for Italians, and that's definitely on trend. And obviously I'm working with Cucina Libby, and they're number one in Italy. But you know, just like even being in Italy and talking to them and meeting the ambassador of Italy, like it's the kitchen is and dining is the centre of their homes. So it's really like a trend piece. Anyone who wants to follow Italian design, like that is the place that you have to kind of like have everything covered. It has to be stylish, but it also has to fit 40 cousins and friends. So it's kind of that balance.
Right. Okay. Well, of course, some of us do like to do that to some degree or other.
Yeah, yeah, so
during the summer particularly. And that means then that creating an interior or a table that allows for that is really, really important. So talk to me a little bit about the best way to go about that. Are you looking at one of these big, long kind of butcher block tables with loads of chairs around them? Or are there ways that we can work
in an ideal world, but
inside,
not in the Irish property market? I think everyone listening at home is probably thinking there's not a hope right now. But in an ideal world, you would have a beautiful long table and you could just add on chairs. But in reality, I think there's a couple of different options. You could have, like, you know, a large table or a table which is extendable. Mm. You know, there's different ones. Or else, I think I've mentioned this before, but you could have, I think, a brilliant kind of plan would be to have some garden furniture, which you can bring in and outside, depending on the season. And then you can add them, kind of extend them along, Sinead, and then just put tablecloths over it so people don't know. And I think it's just a really handy way. It can also be used outside in summer. So there's just like, I always think each
like kind of fold up stuff.
Yes, exactly. And then you can fold up chairs. And then you can also add on cushions for your VIP guests or the granny, you know, things like that, or high chairs for children. But I definitely think, you know, most people can't afford in terms of space, a large table. Mm. So it's just kind of having that opportunity to extend out.
Now, when you're eating Italian food in that way, sharing plates become really important.
I'm obsessed, honestly. If I ever have my collection, any brands listening, I want the NRD design series. I want like an Italian sharing plate. I'm obsessed with small bowls. Like, I know this is such a ridiculous thing to say, but I love sharing plates. All my friends and family would say that about me. And it's because I think food is for sharing.
Mm.
And I definitely think that's an Italian thing. I think, you know, you know, genuinely not think everyone, wouldn't think everyone agrees with that. But, you know, just having that opportunity of putting out different things for everyone to try, and everyone leans each over each other's plates and tries each other's pasta. And I love that. Mm. I think it's just very, I don't know, I think that's what food's all about. I think it's a very sensual experience, and interiors comes into that with your tableware and your table settings.
And of course, it makes for a more festive atmosphere. Absolutely. People talking over each other, yeah, reaching over each other, you know, and it makes it kind of more fun in that way. So if you're styling for an Italian look, then what are we talking about, Natasha?
I suppose it depends on which kind of area you're looking for. Like, you could get a Sicilian look, or you could get, you know, just a very plain look, or a very traditional kind of picnic look if you're kind of going into your garden and having a gazebo. But I really love the design table. It's an Irish brand, Tara O'Connor, and she's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, we've had Tara on the show before. She's fabulous. And she has lovely signature looks.
Yeah, and I think that's her brand would be a perfect way to look at different options. Some of them look very Sicilian with the orange, you know, you can think of the oranges there. And then some of them would be kind of more Rome and a bit more like big city. But I really think that just kind of embracing a theme, and I feel like, think of a picnic, you know, think of going on a picnic, and that's the way Italian design would be, because it's very stylish and colourful, but it's also kind of traditional. It's got that sense of tradition. It's not super modern. It always has that sense of tradition with the patterns or the colours or textures, and obviously the textures of the tea cloths and stuff. You know, they're not overly fancy, they're cosy, they're things that your granny would make, you know, that way. But obviously the design table is a very fancy version of that, and just like colourful, and just lots of different plates and different kind of lots of napkins and lots of glasses for, you know, your wines and all your, they love wine in Italy. So, yeah. You know, all those different things. And as I said, depending on whether it's inside or outside, yeah, you know, you could mix it up.
So it's kind of a more rustic look. I mean, it's not terribly formal, for instance.
No, I don't
think so. And, it, you know, that idea of having actually it's brilliant to go over somewhere, even like IKEA, and what they sell as dishcloths, you know, as kind of napkin dishcloths, you can actually use as napkins.
I've done that in Project Sinead through lastminute.com a few times, and show homes, the developers are all going, what? And my friend was laughing because I used tablecloths.
Yeah, you know, the stripy cotton ones.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I use them as, you know,
giant napkins.
But they're brilliant because
you need that for all the spaghetti, don't you? Tuck it into your neck.
And on your lap and everything. But also they're lovely on table settings. They're thicker and fuller. They're more glamorous. But I think alfresco dining, the outside kind of dining, which is very Italian, you know, you walk down the streets in Italy and you see people on every kind of avenue and everything, yeah, sitting on the street and having meals and things. And I think it is very relaxed. Like, you know, even a really posh restaurant is. And obviously there's some really high end, but I think that alfresco dining is kind of embodies that relaxation, your feet off, wearing sandals. And I know we're in Ireland, so maybe an IKEA gazebo or something like that would be great to put over it, or a canopy. And they've really good ones now, which are affordable, different budgets and stuff. So something like that, but really bringing in that kind of sense of tradition, people coming together and relaxing. It has to have that sense of relaxation and style together.
And that sense that the meal is the entertainment.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not just fueling up before you go and do something else.
Exactly.
It's just sitting there for hours sometimes.
Oh my God, absolutely.
And they've all these courses, you know.
100%. There's so many different levels. Like, there's all these, you see these pictures on social media, you know, come welcome to an Italian house and there's 500 plates. Like, it's a joke, but it's not really. Yeah, because my family are very like that. And a lot of people have commented, my friends are like, you really like to feed. And it's usually a great thing, but, you know, it's something that it's definitely a cultural thing. And I think having that, I don't know, I just feel like we've just come out of COVID and it's a nice thing. Like, I know it's a couple of years now, but having been through that experience, going away and seeing people kind of coming together, it's very joyous.
It is. And it's something that's very, very easy to replicate. And
absolutely,
who doesn't love a bowl of spaghetti at the end of the day? Easiest thing in the world
absolutely
to do.
Absolutely.
Natasha, you have loads of ideas on your Instagram.
Yeah, I'll put some photos up, you know, some ideas.
Natasha, you can search there for Natasha Rocca Divine and find all of that stuff here and get in the mood for summer, whether or not the weather complies. And that is all we have time for on the latest episode of the Home Show podcast. I hope this week gave you some food for thought, whether it was installing an aquarium, building your nursery, putting in a bit of stained glass, or finding yourself in an Italian garden. Nobody can say we're not eclectic on this podcast. My thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who was producing this week. Stephen McLoone was on sound. And if you missed any episodes, or indeed any of this episode, you can check it on our podcast, which is on newstalk.com, wherever you get your podcasts from, or on the Newstalk app, which is powered by Go Loud. Thank you for your company and thank you for listening. And we'll see you all again next time.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan.
With Mila.
Saturday morning at 8 on Newstalk.